Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where long-term performance is driven by original, fundamental research on a global scale. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
This recession has been mostly about jobs, how many of them the economy is losing, and how long it's taking to get them back. Today, what we might be able to learn from where the job market has already been. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
American Public Media presents After the Bell, a weekly podcast that makes sense of the week in business and the economy, available at marketplace.org.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. It is Wednesday today, the 5th of August. Great to have you here. And stop me if you've heard this one before, that unemployment is what economists call a lagging indicator. It tells us loads about what's already happened, maybe not so much about where things might go. But the job losses this time around have been so steep and the recession so long that some economists are starting to worry the labor market might be something of a leading indicator, so weak that it could kill any recovery before it starts. Marketplace's Steve Henn reports.
Economist Ray Perriman hopes and believes that the worst days of this recession are behind us.
Oh, I think we're pretty close to the bottom right now. We're kind of rolling along the bottom of the U right now.
Perriman's not expecting the economy to quickly climb out of that ditch, in part because the job market is so bad. The unemployment rate could break 10% any day.
It's tough to make a case for a recovery when employment conditions are as tough as they are right now.
Hugh Johnson at Johnson Illington Advisors says high unemployment, like we're seeing now, can create its own vicious cycle. When enough folks are out of work, even the gainfully employed trim their spending out of fear. Foreclosures tend to creep up, banks suffer, and businesses often decide to trim their payrolls even further.
Clearly, having roughly 10% of the population unemployed creates a drain.
Ray Perriman.
You would have more spending if you had more people employed.
And more spending would give businesses the push they need to start hiring. But the question right now is, will government programs like the stimulus and cash for clunkers convince enough consumers to start spending again to make a difference? Or will rising unemployment sap the economy's momentum, leaving us all stuck in a ditch? In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
All of that as a setup, by the way, for Friday's July unemployment report. Some of the early sales figures from the Cash for Clunkers program are in. You could think of them as a referendum on Detroit, if you will, with American car buyers doing the voting through their purchases. To get the biggest rebate they can, a lot of customers are going for smaller, more fuel-efficient vehicles. The Ford Focus tops the list, but foreign companies dominate the rest of the top 10. Our senior business correspondent Bob Moon has more.
Besides Ford's Focus, four foreign brands round out the top five on the government's list. They are the Toyota Corolla, Honda Civic, Toyota Prius, and Toyota Camry. Which raises the question, is that the American auto industry that Transportation Secretary Ray LaHood was talking about this week on MSNBC?
I don't think there's any question about it. This is the lifeline that will bring back the automobile industry in America.
Despite their mostly foreign brand names, nearly all the top-selling clunker replacement vehicles are built in North America. Mark Cannon is a spokesman for the country's largest automobile retailer, AutoNation. He argues the foreign-dominated list doesn't necessarily bode ill for America's troubled car companies.
I don't think it's a vote against Detroit. Remember, in the 1990s, Detroit's market share was 70%. Today it hovers in the low 40s. So really what you're seeing is the buy-it habit of the American public today. I think when it's all said and done, the market share is going to look very much like the sales ratio did before this program.
At the consulting group CSM Worldwide, auto sales analyst George Augustitis wonders if consumer preferences are really all that different. He says the $4,500 per vehicle incentive was targeted specifically at improving fuel economy, but general sales figures on Ford's market-leading pickup might tell a different story.
If you could have purchased a 2009-2010 F-150 that got 18 miles to the gallon and still got your full 4,500, people would have done it. The F-Series was the number one selling vehicle in the month of July.
Indeed, even Transportation Secretary LaHood admitted this week where his preferences lie. He told MSNBC he has his eye on a four-wheel drive Ford Explorer. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
We are just on the leading edge of back-to-you-know-what season, and retailers are trying everything they can to pry the money out of consumers' hands before school starts. With the economy the way it is, though, they've basically got two choices, markdowns and must-haves. Retailers like that second one, of course, because they can still make a little bit of money there. So this season, they are pinning their hopes on a very familiar pattern, Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith explains.
After more than a year of being pounded by the recession, retailers think they've finally found a strategy for success. Plaid.
We're just kind of mad about Plaid here.
Carolyn Wangsted is vice president of trend for JCPenney. She says Plaid is a pillar for the fall. She says it works for men and women, and you can put it on anything.
An assortment of tops, jackets, outerwear, handbags, scarves, hats, you name it. We call it total plaidness around here. That's kind of our joke.
But this season, Plaid is serious business. Adrian Tennant is an apparel analyst with FBR Capital Markets. She says retailers are banking on Plaid becoming a must-have.
It's very important to have something that will drive and generate that full price sale, because now we really have to get her off of bargain hunting.
Families are expected to spend about 8% less on back-to-school shopping than they did last year. Plaid fits into that pattern too, says Wendy Liebman, CEO of WSL Strategic Retail. She says you can put the print on any fabric, from cashmere to cotton, so even cash-strapped shoppers can get their Plaid on.
This sense of trying to make even the trend merchandise affordable has been really a mantra for most of the retailers around the country.
And some of us may not even have to buy anything if we can just find those old flannel shirts, which are probably somewhere in the garage with our Nirvana posters, Doc Martens, and fingerless gloves. I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
Yeah, I don't know. Plaid? I do think the summer rally has melted in the heat of August, though. Wall Street just didn't have any energy today. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. There comes a time in every recession when companies just have to roll the dice, make those investments, buy that inventory or pay for those ads, and just hope consumers are going to be in a mood to start buying again sometime real soon. We thought we saw some signs of that in our morning meeting today, so we've called Bill Patterson to check our instincts. He's with the market research firm Mintel International. Bill, good to talk with you.
Hi, Kai. How you doing?
I'm well. Listen, I wanted to chat for a second about a couple of items ripped from the headlines today along these lines of how companies bounce back from this recession. The first one is John Mackey, the CEO of Whole Foods, quoted today in the Wall Street Journal talking about candy and how the store is going to get healthier again. He said, we used to just sell healthy food, but we know it's not enough. We sell all kinds of candy. We sell a bunch of junk. And this is the CEO of the company. What kind of marketing strategy is that as you try to get out of this recession?
It makes me remember the comment by Gerald Ratner when he said that his jewelry company sold a load of junk and it did him no favors at all. But I think John Mackey's in a much better position. He's right in the right place now because, you know, they need to do something to turn that company around.
Do they risk perhaps losing more people than they gain by fessing up in a way?
I don't think so. Really, the story with them is that back in pre-recession times, we had a situation where the consumer was desperately looking for natural, organic, and Whole Foods was satisfying that. When the recession hit, it really seems that the pocketbook started to talk. A lot of the consumers started saying, okay, you know, we'll forego that because right now it's more important that we balance our household budgets. And right now, I mean, it seems to be that most economists are saying, you know, that the recession is starting to bottom out. And if that's the case, then from a consumer demand perspective, we're expecting to see that pent-up and latent demand for natural organics start to grow again. And frankly, if Whole Foods can revamp themselves now, they should be well placed to take advantage of the rebound when it comes.
Let me try another one then on you, Bill. Procter & Gamble announced a deal this morning with the National Football League. It's going to provide Head & Shoulders and some other of its products to be locker room products for the NFL. And as one editor put it around our table this morning, is allying yourself with sweaty, hulking guys a way to sell a product coming out of a recession?
The first thing you've got to remember, that they've suffered from, again, this kind of recessionary mindset we've had where people have been moving to private label because we've seen a lot of growth in private label.
When you say private label, you mean generics and something cheaper,
basically. Store brand, yeah. And they need to do something to address that. I'm frankly always surprised by some of the associations that get developed, but we certainly see from the sales figures that they seem to work. And, you know, I guess if you're talking about personal care products and you're cleaning up a bunch of footballers, then it seems to be a pretty good match.
Is what we're seeing here companies figuring out how to get back into the economy as consumers look a little more ready to spend?
The issue with consumer spend is very much driven by confidence. And the smart companies will, in fact, be already looking forward to the time when the purse strings start to loosen up again. So companies really need to be on their toes right now because the consumer is going to be switching their behavior. There will be some residual effect of the recession mindset, but keeping a really close eye on consumer sentiment, consumer mood, and consumer patterns is going to be really key.
Bill Patterson, he's a senior research analyst at the Mintel Research Group. They're an international market research firm. Bill, thanks a lot.
Kai, thank you.
For women in the Middle East, finding their place in business has never been the easiest thing. In Lebanon, though, entrepreneurial women have had the official support of the government, laws that were passed in the early 1990s after the Lebanese Civil War ended that were designed to improve their professional prospects. In the nearly 20 years since, Lebanese women have been slowly catching up, and the most recent development is an industry by women for women. Don Duncan reports now from Beirut.
There's a revolution in the streets of Beirut, and it's hot pink. Banat Taxi is a new cab service for women. Its name in Arabic means girl taxi, and all 12 of its cars are painted pink.
I can offer my clients a feminine atmosphere in which to travel. You can see from the drivers, clean, elegant, professional.
That's owner Nawal Fakhri. Her office is abuzz with drivers, all women in white shirts with pink ties and pink flowers in their hair. If you're a guy, they won't stop for you unless you're traveling with a woman. Since launching in March, these pink ladies have been turning heads all over Beirut.
I felt it was a very nice idea.
Randa Bader is one of Banat Taxi's customers. She's also an executive at Lebanon's largest bank, Bank Audi, and was responsible for the launch of Lebanon's first women-only credit card. Bader has noticed similar ventures popping up all over the country, like women-only gyms and even women plumbers.
Women are an essential part of the society and the economy, especially for spending. So what matters for us in the credit card business is spending.
So Bader launched Shine Card, a credit card with a special feature for the Lebanese lady. One side of the card is a mirror.
The woman can put lipstick by looking at herself in the card after finishing handing this card to the, for example, to the waiter in the restaurant to pay for the bill.
The mirror card is now one of the most profitable cards in Bank Audi's portfolio. The American University of Beirut is home to Lebanon's top business school, and these days more than half of its students are women. Dean of the school, George Najjar, says he sees many of them coming up with business ideas to provide goods and services specifically for women.
You see that in terms of the issues raised in classrooms, in terms of the research project pursued. We are moving very fast towards a world of equality, where women are given their due. And this is nobody's favor. They have earned it.
Taxi owner Nawal Fakhri is poised to collect her dues this summer. Lebanon is expected to bring in a lot of tourists. And 30% of them come from conservative Gulf states, where women are forbidden to travel with any man other than male relatives. Those female tourists are prime candidates for Fakhri's pink taxis.
I'm not building my business on tourism. Lebanon is just too unstable to depend on it. But the women who come here from the Gulf, they're certainly a bonus for me.
Fakhri says her fleet will double by the end of summer, and she expects to recoup her initial $200,000 investment by the end of this year. Not bad for what started as a flash of pink. In Beirut, I'm Don Duncan for Marketplace.
Coming up, you remember those dreams where you're in school in your underwear? Now think recession nightmares.
Each individual's dreams becomes kind of a window into how the numbers of the economy and the facts and figures we read in the paper, how they're impacting people at a very personal level.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial shed 39 points today, about a 0.5%, closed at 9,280. The NASDAQ dropped 18 points, almost 1%, finished back below the 2,000 mark, 1993, the number. The S&P 500 slipped 2 points, about a third of 1%, to wind up, or wind down, I suppose the case may be, at 1,002. Reports that the service sector is still in the dumps helped fuel that decline. Shares of coffee retailer Starbucks cooled off more than 1% today. But things weren't all bad. Shares of discount online travel site Orbitz flew 23% higher today. Polo Ralph Lauren, or Ralph Lauren, I can never figure out which one it is. Anyway, it posted its 8th straight quarter of better-than-expected profit. Shares galloped 7% higher. And stop the presses, there was good news from Detroit. Shares of car parts maker American Axle burned rubber by more than 40%. That after the company predicted better financial results for the rest of the year. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.76%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act. Why is a cram down like a slice of cake? Visit the Marketplace whiteboard to find out. It's on our website, marketplace.org. There you'll find videos unwrapping the basics of the financial crisis.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at the events for Thursday. Major retailers report July sales figures. We'll see how much summer stuff people bought or didn't. The European Central Bank, kind of like the Fed over here, will look at whether to raise or lower its interest rate or keep them steady. And in the U.S. and in Japan, people remember the victims of the atomic bomb dropped on Hiroshima in 1945. I'm Megan Larson.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. It was a public policy grab bag for the president today out in Wakarusa, Indiana. He talked health care for a while. He promised to get a reform bill passed by the end of the year. And he played up his economic stimulus package, too. He announced almost $2.5 billion in stimulus grants for electric car manufacturing. Stimulus has been a theme of his the past couple of days. Last week, he said the improvement in economic growth shows his spending plan is working. Perhaps, but commentator David Frum says not all stimulus plans are created equal.
Economic bad news is arriving at a slower pace these days. Some days, there's even good news, like the jump in home sales in June. These glimmers have led one news magazine to pronounce the recession over. Not so fast. But there is another economy in North America where optimism does seem justified, north of the border. The Bank of Canada predicts that the Canadian economy will resume expansion in the fall, the first G7 economy to emerge from recession. Canada's central bank predicts 1.3% growth in the third quarter of 2009, 3% in the fourth. To some extent, Canada is benefiting from unplanned good luck. Canada's housing market did not inflate the way America's did, so it had less far to fall. Natural resources constitute a larger share of the Canadian economy than in the United States, so Canada profits more from China's recovering demand for raw materials. But policy matters too. Like the United States, Canada adopted a stimulus plan. But while the American plan amounted to almost 5% of GDP over 3 years, Canada's plan gave a jolt of 2.5% in a little more than 1 year. So Canada got more bang for less buck. If both countries' projections prove accurate, Canadians in 2015 will shoulder only about one-third as much debt per person as Americans. More and more, the $800 billion stimulus plan is looking like a great mistake. Too much long-term debt for too little immediate benefit, all of it too closely tied to the Democratic Party's political imperatives in the 2010 election cycle. The result? An unemployment rate in the United States fully 1 point higher than in Canada. To paraphrase a television commercial, familiar to Canadians of a certain age, only in Canada. What a pity.
David Frum is a resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, also a proud native son of the Great White North. Take a minute to send us your thoughts. Our website is marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. It's been almost a year now since Lehman Brothers wound up in the care of bankruptcy courts. Of course, that doesn't mean the company's troubles are over. Its creditors are still lining up to try to get their money back. And near the top of the list of really big claims is a familiar name, the city of New York. Marketplace's Amy Scott reports.
You know what they say about death and taxes being the only certain things in life. Apparently, the tax man hangs around even after a company dies. The city of New York is trying to collect $627 million in corporate and rent taxes from Lehman Brothers.
This would be an extraordinarily large settlement from one firm.
George Sweeting is deputy director of New York's Independent Budget Office. He says the city might collect a total of $500 or $600 million a year in underpaid taxes through its corporate audits.
On the other hand, these were unbelievably lucrative years for the finance industry, certainly from 2003 to 2007. And as the city gets further into the audit process for those years, there may be, you know, numbers this big again.
The city says Lehman underpaid its taxes going back to the mid-1990s. Peter Faber is a corporate tax lawyer with McDermott, Will & Emery. He says it's not unusual for audits to take many years, and he says it doesn't imply any wrongdoing by Lehman Brothers.
The tax laws are very complicated, and companies and tax administrators very often disagree about what they mean. And very often, those disagreements end up in court.
Because this dispute wound up in bankruptcy court, the city may have to beat out other creditors to get paid. The money would come in handy. The city's expected to fall around $5 billion short on its budget next fiscal year. In New York, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
We did a series of stories this past spring about how the recession and the financial crisis have affected the American dream and whether that dream is even a possibility anymore. But it occurred to us that there is one aspect of the American dream that hasn't gotten much attention, the actual dreaming part, as in what kinds of dreams Americans are having a year and a half into a recession. We sent Marketplace's Chrissy Clark on a tour of the American subconscious.
Ask anyone if they've had a dream about the economy lately, and their answer's probably going to sound something like Hugh Dwyer's. He's an athletic director from New Jersey who I recently stopped on the street.
I wouldn't call them dreams, more like nightmares.
The nightmares come in all shapes and sizes. For Carol McCartney, a retired pharmacist from Colorado, they're about
homelessness. We were in our car, and we were cold.
And for this school administrator from Ohio, Jane Jasper,
I was falling into a huge hole and worried about paying bills.
Falling dreams, homeless dreams, lose your job dreams, they're a common complaint these days, according to Kelly Bulkley. He's a dream researcher at the Graduate Theological Union in Berkeley, California.
Each individual's dreams becomes kind of a window into how the numbers of the economy and the facts and figures we read in the paper, how they're impacting people at a very personal level. Dreams really come to the fore during times of uncertainty to help us make sense of the craziness that we're all experiencing.
And sometimes it's hard to decide which is crazier, the dream or the reality it's reflecting.
Charles Schwab was sitting in sort of like a soundstage in between takes on a commercial.
Take this dream that a sports writer named Charlie Schroeder had recently about Charles Schwab. Yes, that Charles Schwab, the founder of the investment firm.
But he looked nothing like Charles Schwab. He kind of looked a little bit like Malcolm Gladwell, Sid Vicious. He had spiky hair, like the shock of hair, and a suit and a thin black tie. I must have been looking at him sort of quizzically because he looked at me. He's like, hey, man, you never know with me. I'm kind of crazy. I like to mix things up. I'm Charles Schwab.
I asked our resident dream analyst, Kelly Bulkley, to pull out his pipe and do his Freudian dream thing on this one.
I do not smoke, sorry. And I don't have a beard. I've got a little stubble, so I'll scratch my stubble for you. There you go. When people dream of prominent public figures that we don't personally know, it often reflects some qualities that those public figures represent to us.
So given the current economic upheaval, Bulkley says this dream makes a certain kind of dream world sense. Charles Schwab, once a pillar of stability and sobriety in the financial world, has suddenly gone crazy. Lance Kimmel is a corporate attorney who specializes in mergers and acquisitions.
Oh, gosh, this is embarrassing. I actually have clients and colleagues who listen to Marketplace.
His dream was a variation on the old unprepared student classic.
I kind of thought that it was a history or political science exam, and I could probably wing it. But then in the front of the room is Bernanke.
Yes, that Bernanke. Ben Bernanke, the chairman of the Federal Reserve. And the test was on how to fix the economy.
I'm having trouble keeping the checkbook in order right now, let alone the nation's economy and the world financial markets.
Tell me about it. So is there anything economically useful about the recession dreams people are having these days? That's what I asked behavioral economist Dan Ariely. And he said, yes, as stressful as dreams can be, they can also give us a chance to think differently about how to solve economic problems in our waking lives.
If dreams can help us open the possibility that there are more different inputs and approaches, maybe we will come up with more creative ideas. And maybe even more, maybe we should all recommend to Bernanke to start thinking this way as he goes to sleep.
That is, if Bernanke's actually getting any sleep these days. I'm Chrissy Clark for Marketplace.
Sweet If you want some insights into what your dreams may be telling you, go to our website. We do dream interpretations there now, it seems. It's marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, offering absolute return funds with goals designed to match yours. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note today, a financial postscript to former President Bill Clinton's trip to North Korea yesterday. After his plane with the two American journalists on board landed at Burbank Airport here in Los Angeles this morning, we got the answer to whose plane it was and who paid for the trip. According to the company that manages the aircraft, it belongs to Hollywood producer Stephen Bing. Make that wealthy Hollywood producer and longtime friend of the Clintons, both of them. Bing raised $100,000 for then-Senator Hillary Clinton's presidential campaign. He's also given $10 million to the former president's library and charitable foundation. I honestly thought it was the CIA the whole time. I don't know. That is Marketplace from American Public Media this Wednesday afternoon. Today, the Dow dropped 39 points, 0.5%. The Nasdaq lost 18 points, almost 1%. The S&P 500 down 2 points, about 1/3 of 1%. Vahan Baladuni, Ravi Karman, Stephen Colon, Andrea Jackson-Gewirtz, Eric Johnson, Jeff Peters, and Charlton Thorpe engineered the program for us. Coming up next time, it's not so easy to modify a mortgage when you don't know who to pay.
There are too many people stirring the pie, so you don't know who to really go to. We thought it was just with Wells Fargo. And I'm saying, who is these investors?
I'm Kai Rizdal. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.